Going? Okay, we'll get started. So, first of all, it's great to see so many of you here. Good afternoon to everybody. I know a lot of you in the room, not everybody. I'm Christine Chinkin. I'm a professorial research fellow at the Center for Women, Peace and Security, and also the principal investigator in a project which is not directly for today. I mean, it's not under the auspices of the project, but it's very much related, which is on a feminist international law of peace, get it in the right order. And very much what we'll be talking about today is, in fact, you know, what is, how do we understand the concepts of feminism, international law and peace together within a single framework? First thing I ought to do is to thank the library, and particularly Daniel, very much indeed, for putting this on and doing this this afternoon. So thank you. And also for the Wolf members, who have been instrumental again in this whole series and in the exhibition downstairs. So if people have not looked at the exhibition in the foyer, I suggest you do so. What we're actually going to do this afternoon is actually have a three-way conversation. So I'm not really chairing, I'm conversing. And so the three-way conversation is going to be between Madeleine Rees, who I think most of you here know. Madeleine, of course, is Secretary General of WILF, so it's absolutely great to have you here, Madeleine. And with Dr. Louise Arimatsu, who is a fellow principal investigator on the project relating to feminist international law of peace and security, and is a distinguished policy research fellow at the Center for Women, Peace and Security. So we will kick off, Louise.
So Madeleine was involved in a workshop we hosted here at the LSE, and at lunchtime we were in the atrium looking at this exhibition. And I don't know whether many of you have been up to see the exhibition, and I highly recommend it, but this was the photograph that came up and as we were standing looking at it, and Madeleine and I started to have this conversation about these women, because they are truly amazing. And I thought, no, what a better moment than to begin to, well, to ask Madeleine to share your views, your thoughts, reflections on seeing an image of these women.
I might say it a little differently than the way I said it yesterday, because you're here. But just when you look at those amazing women, they look absolutely formidable. And I just feel, there they are, sitting behind me, looking over my shoulder as the Secretary General of WILF, poking at me to make sure that I am not deviating from what it was they said that we had to do in order to bring peace. So I'm trying my best, girls, really. But really, it's quite an amazing feat, because, as I say, that picture encapsulates, I think, what was really the essence of the beginnings of WILF all those years ago. When you think of it, it's quite incredible. It's over 100 years that the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom has existed.
And, I mean, what's even more remarkable, thinking about it, is this picture is taken in the middle of World War One.
Yeah?
In the middle of World War One, when, you know, the guns are going just a very few miles, really, from where they are. And there they are, discussing how to bring peace, and doing what, Madeleine? What was that early history of WILF?
And this is something, in 2015, we had our 100th anniversary, when we brought over 1,000 women back to The Hague. And the reason we did that, because these women managed to get 1,300 women from all over to The Hague to protest and make known the causes of the war and to try to bring its end. They weren't so naive to think, oh, just because we're here, it's going to stop. But what we need to do is protest its existence and to try to, and to really expose the slaughter that's happening just so close to where they were having the meeting. And when you think of it, you know, we think getting 1,000 people around, that's not so difficult these days, because we've got internet, we still use the snail mail if we need. But this lot, how on earth did they do it? When you think, in the middle of a war, women from Britain not allowed to go, some managed to sneak out and get around the back way and get into to boats to get across, but passport denied, not allowed to travel. Mrs. Pethick Lawrence, who was one of the founder members of WILF, she happened to be in the States, so she managed to get on the boat that went from the States. There were women coming from absolutely all over. The Australians were late because the weather was bad. Their ship couldn't get in. But it was an incredible feat when you think of it. And every single one of them was a suffragette. Every single one of them had come to demand, had come from a background of voluntarism and activism. Firstly, to get women the vote. Secondly, then, to get women's voices into Parliament. Thirdly, to bring voices of women into Parliament in order to achieve peace. And it was in that moment that they formed the beginnings of an organisation which in 1919 in Zurich went on to become formally adopted the name of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom.
And just to pick up on Pethick Lawrence, those of you who are in the towers which is where the Centre for Women, Peace and Security is housed, Pethick Lawrence, I think, is highly appropriate for the building that has got the Centre for Women, Peace and Security, because she was one of the women who did manage to get there. And isn't there something very ironic that it was easier for her to get there from America than it was across the Channel, because it was the British government that were essentially stopping women getting over. But I think sort of another sort of 2 points that are really about this whole meeting. One, it's about women's networking. Yeah, you're seeing this absolutely clearly. It's about women's resistance. Two methodologies that I think still very much are part of women's activism today.
So I just want to pick up now.
We have a script, by the way. We keep deviating.
We've deviated
so many times already.
So back to the topic, and in fact, the theme, the topic that we highlighted today, which in fact Madeline raised, was: are we asking the right questions? And this kind of echoes something that Virginia Woolf observed on the eve of the Second World War. And she said this, that while men were asking the question, how do we prevent conflict, women, and she in particular, were asking the question, why fight? So there you go. I'm going to come back to you, Madeline.
And that, in a way, was the answer given by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom after their analysis of the root causes of the conflict to the First World War, and which is one which we have more or less stuck to, because why change something that is brilliant in its analysis and simple in its analysis? And they said, and this is going to have resonance for you now, causation of conflict, inequalities between people and between nations. Militarism as a way of thought, the armaments industry, particularly when privatised, and the obvious need to have a multilateral system which would then bring an end to war by stopping conflict through dialogue. Now, that is a fairly profound group of analyses, which to me, especially when I came into war first time, the one that I'd been an equalities anti-discrimination lawyer, so that part I completely got, but I'd never really thought of militarism as a way of thought. And when you actually reflect on that and see what it means, it is absolutely all-pervasive. It touches on so many different aspects of our lives without us even knowing that. So I think their vision, if you like, and their analysis in those times, from 1915-1919 onwards, was really very much to point.
I think one of the other things that they really emphasised in that first set of resolutions was that, this is an era following on from the 1899-1907 Hague peace conferences, when there'd been a sort of move about trying to make war safe, bring the humanitarian aspect into warfare. And they just say it. War can never be made safe for women.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, is something that we've lost, this notion that, let's be absolutely upfront about what war and conflict is. But just to pick up on something else that Madeline said a moment ago, I think it's really interesting when you look at the history of women's organisation at the turn of the 20th century. And what were women organising around? They were organising around political participation, obviously getting the vote. They were organising particularly around issues of peace as you move into that part of the 20th century. They were organising around employment, safe wages, safe working conditions for women, and the sort of situations in which women so often find themselves in, unsafe, poorly paid, difficult forms of labour. They become very active a few years later, following on from Zurich, in the origins of the International Labour Organization, for example, and around that. But, you know, we mustn't think that there was this total cohesion between women at that time. And of course, what we're also seeing at exactly the same period, a great division between women. There was clearly the division in the suffragette movement relating to the use of violence in their own campaigns. And then, of course, as World War One comes out, the division between women on pacifism, should we reject the whole concept of war altogether, or do we put this aside at this point and support our country that is right, the patriotism, the coming. So, you know, how does that fit into the early years of Wilf?
Well, Wilf, we're on that side. There is no such thing as war which can be justifiable. You have to discuss, explain, and mediate, which is why big, strong supporters of, first of all, the League of Nations, and then thereafter, you know, and still supporters of the United Nations, warts and all, we still have to reform it, but we still, it's the only show in town that might actually bring peace, so we have to actually support it. But I think the point is a broader one, and this goes very much back to what happens when we are, a movement is hijacked by nationalism in the guise of it, which is actually a manifestation of what we were talking about before, militarism and patriarchy. Because essentially, it shows how gender relations can be co-opted. Mm-hmm. So essentially, those women who were supporting the conflict were shifted, if you like, away from let's have universal suffrage, let's do the things that I was saying earlier, to now we've got to win a war. And so to do that, we have to go back into our positions of before, give support to our men to go off and fight. Then you have the, because it reflects absolutely the structures of authority within which they had been campaigning previously. So it put on hold everything that they'd been campaigning for and showed how women are co-opted into structures in order to perpetuate nationalist ideas. So the women who were handing out the white feathers to the guys who wouldn't go to fight, or who they thought weren't going to fight, and the incredible persecution of those men who were who refused to fight with conscientious objectors, who should be national heroes but never were and never are. So I think that's huge. And then the other part, of course, is the waving off at the stations. And just to say, because it had huge traction for me looking at some of the pictures and everything from the First World War when I went to Ukraine. And it was right at the 2015, at the beginnings of the 2014-15, beginnings of that conflict. And you know, sitting and watching the televisions broadcasting all this nationalist, what was going on? Women at train stations giving flowers to guys who were going off to the front, who were giving back the babies they'd just kissed goodbye. You know, they could have put it in black and white and we'd been back. It was the same thing, that co-option of women into a system which was inherently militarized and increasingly pushing an agenda for conflict. And I think that's something we always have to be very, very much aware of, is we've got to hold the line, we've got to actually say, no, you, whatever the situation, we do not get to the point where we have to have conflict. And I'm afraid, I know I'm going off script a little bit here, but very, very important is that we find ourselves getting derailed time and time again, because the emphasis is always when the conflict has started. We don't do enough to do, well, what's going on now, before the conflict has started, and how do we mediate that? So we don't get to the co-option of women into a nationalist dialogue.
But it's not just co-option, is it? It's also this sort of instrumentalization of women that is part of that. And, I mean, you've just brought it, you know, just spanned the 100 years or so of history by going from World War One to the Ukraine. But I suspect everybody in the room also remembers at the 2001, the time of the invasion of Afghanistan, when a part, again, of building the support for that invasion of Afghanistan was very much, look, this is for the benefit of women. It's for the benefit of women in Afghanistan. Now, quite clearly, the Taliban was one of the most gender unequal regimes that we could possibly have had. But at the same time, the shifting the language about why the invasion was to be supported, because it is also about addressing issues relating to women under the Taliban regime. And yet then that language disappears when it becomes less convenient. So at times when, well, maybe we can negotiate with the Taliban over a peace agreement, for example, and suddenly that gender importance is no longer built upon. So it's co-option, instrumentalization, imagery at all points that is making gender and gender analysis complicit, essentially, in ways that we don't always realise are happening. And as you said, that we have to hold that line and resist.
Can I just say, because I think what's really important about that, is nobody asks the women.
Nobody asks the women.
No, it's like, we have this now, so oh, this is good for you, this war. It will save you from the Taliban. But if you then talk to what women were saying at the time, was actually sometimes having the Taliban come in was better than having a series of warlords come through and be raped again and again and again by them, because the Taliban stopped that. Yeah. And so, you know, better that, and I have to wear this for a bit, because then at least I'm getting a break. And that's what they were saying afterwards. Nobody asked them.
But also the complexity of that.
Absolutely.
And I think this is something we're probably going to come back to. But, you know, this binary divide of good, bad, and without getting into those underlying issues.
Yeah. So we have gone so off script. Okay, I'm now on page 7. But I do want to come back to, because, you know, there's so many things that you raise here, because one of the things that, you know, to ask that question of, are we asking the right question, it's not so much that shouldn't be directed at us. Okay, we are actually asking the right questions and asking the right questions at the right time. Okay, it is those who have power, surely, who are asking the wrong questions at the wrong time. You know, so I kind of see that in the context of Iraq, that it's after the event, they'll raise a question in order to already have an answer to justify their intervention. You know, and so when I talk to you about other situations right now around the globe, when we talk about Cameroon, you know, that it's, what are the questions that we're missing today that could, that whereby we don't even come to the point where we ask that question, how can we prevent conflict?
But are we asking today the same questions as the women were asking in 1915? Now, that you should be pleased with that. That's back on cue.
Yeah. But the answer to that one is yes. Because I think the big difference is, if you ask, say, Cameroon, get race Cameroon, if you ask the analysis to come from the UN or from any of the multilateral systems, then they would look at the geopolitical situation. Whereas if you ask the questions that Wilf was asking, which is the root cause analysis, why are we where we are and how do we fix that? And what we have done as Wilf in this, the last few years, has been to say, well, we possibly, that we've asked the right questions, they've come up with the right way of doing the analysis. What we need to do is recontextualize that so that it fits with what is happening in the current international malaise, shall we say. So one of the things that we have really tried to push for, and it's linked very much to the analysis about inequalities between people and the nations and, you know, militarism, is to look at where we are. And that is, militarism still very much a core component, now underscored, underpinned, and funded by neoliberalism, clearly. We need to look at the political economy within communities and within countries and globally in order to better understand how we change the analysis away from a binary into one which is actually integrated in all of its complexity. Because we think by doing that, we can then see, for example, in the situation of Cameroon, what is really going on? Where are the fault lines that are now leading to probable conflict? And if you know where the fault lines are, And you know where the power brokers are within those, where the economic actors, the political actors, the military actors, where the women are and where the women have their influence and where the non-violent men are who can provide the support to that, then you move backwards away from that and see who has influence. So how can you influence the economic actors to do the right thing? How can you influence those countries which might be able to ameliorate language differences, which is one of the major issues in Cameroon? And it's Canada. And they said, yes, we can help with that. So how can you get the countries who could help through a peaceful dialogue in a mediated manner to actually bring an end to or prevent what could become a full-on maelstrom? Instead of doing, well, it's all about where we drew the line in the sand. Yes, true, it was where we drew the line in the sand. But let's not go back to ancient tribal hatreds. We've done that analysis before, and it doesn't help, because then it says, well, the English speakers are going to hate the French speakers and vice versa. No, they're not. They were fine before, so what's gone wrong? Just, same Bosnia. It's not ancient tribal hate. What's gone wrong? What has suddenly created this? It's like Brexit. We didn't all hate Brexiteers and they didn't all hate Remainers. I've just identified which side I was on, didn't I? before, but now we do, because now a line has been drawn and we've got to get rid of those lines, because it's not us who are drawing the lines. It is those who would seek to continue the political economy which exists, which is the neoliberal model, underpinned, supported by militarism, they're mutually reinforcing. And so we end up where we end up, a binary.
But it's not just drawing lines, is it? It's imposing identities and making those identities part of the line that has been drawn, so that somebody becomes a Leaver or a Remainer.
Yeah.
And that identity starts, or they become a Tutu or a Tutsi or a Hutu or a Bosnian Serb or a Bosnian Croat or a Bosniak. You know, and it's those identities coupled with the lines. Those of you who are in the MSC Women, Peace and Security will know that the Security Council's answer to a lot of this and sort of contemporary international law framework and so on has essentially been Security Council Resolution 1325 on Women, Peace and Security, the seven resolutions that followed 1325. Well, WILF, as an ongoing campaigning, networking, lobbying group around issues of disarmament, around issues of women in armed conflict, was a major player in that movement, particularly between 1995, the Beijing Conference, 2000, the adoption of Women, Peace and Security. And as a major player, presumably WILF celebrated the adoption of 1325. Now, I think you've partly answered this already, but is 1325, you know, would these women here, if you told them, right, now we have this Security Council resolution, would they say, great, we've achieved what we wanted?
I think in 2000 they were going, yay, well done. Save for the fact that we were sold out, said she, with chagrin. I wasn't involved with WILF at the time, but was observing. And all the language on disarmament was struck out before we even got it to the States, which has then undermined the whole resolution from the beginning, because then we just park militarism. Let's take that one out. And then, so yes, you know, we all celebrate, because not so good, we haven't got the disarmament stuff in, but we have got the rest. We have got what they would have been shouting for, which is participation in prevention of conflict. Yes, good, that's what we wanted. We have got participation in the whole panoply that is set out in 1325. But what we haven't got is actually a reframing of the structures which needed to be fundamentally changed. And they did it again. They managed to co-opt the women's movement into 1325, and if you look at all national action plans, great, let's have a whole women in security forces. And so now it's like, how many women have you got in your military, and how many can we deploy in somebody else's country to keep the peace? Well, thank you, that's not exactly what we had in mind. And you know, so much of it has been about co-option, and so much of it has been, yes, let's have women's participation. Yes, I want that. But if we've got to ask the question, participation in what? What is it that we've got as a structure which is going to change those structures in a way which is actually going to do what they would really have been proud of, which is to bring peace? Now, I think for me, and I said this to the class this morning, at the moment, I really have grave concerns about the whole women, peace and security agenda, because it's gone off on a tangent to the extent that you've got fighter pilots who are women, you've got Navy SEALs who are women, basically that we're now in a situation where we could say, well, is having women in the military going to help to bring peace? If you are given an order to go and strafe a village and you're a woman, you say, oh no, there might be children down there. No, you're given an order and you're in the military and you'll do it. And so is it, in a conflict now, you are as likely to be shot by a woman as a man. And I was saying to them, I'd rather be shot for a man because I was shot by a woman than what was the point in everything that we've been doing. But it's come to that. It's come to that. And I think we have really got to seriously reclaim that by reframing the discussion back to where we wanted it and say, your structures don't fit our purpose, are not fit for our purpose, so therefore we have to work with you to change them. I think an example of that is the incredible success of the ICAN campaign in getting a nuclear ban, nuclear treaty ban. Who'd have thought? And I must admit, the wing of Wilf that was been working on that, I was going, oh, good luck, girls. It's too mad. That world is too mad. But of course, working with them to try to help them do it. But they are brilliant, absolutely brilliant in their analysis and everything else. You can see Ray Acheson sitting in the General Assembly, being invited to go and speak on the podium, which he did for 2 hours, answering questions from all the states as to why this was such an issue, convincing them. And what would convince them was individuals within the various country missions that we can't do this. This is really not sane to think that we can have nuclear weapons as a deterrent, because look at the consequences. And it's by looking at the consequences and looking at the structure within the United Nations, which meant that the Security Council was never going to agree, but that the General Assembly could shift that, and then gradually, using the landmine ban approach, isolate those who insisted on having these weapons of mass destruction. And it was that change. Everybody within the structure that existed seeing their individual responsibility towards a common humanity, which prevailed, and Nobel Peace Prize, and let's hope that they do actually get the ratifications to the signatories. But it's that sort of approach, taking it back, reframing it, making it humane or human, and then changing the dialogue and getting the law to reflect that.
Yeah, but can I just come back to you, because I was quite struck by you talking about participation, and we've got there. You said we've got there from their viewpoint, and I'm not sure that we have. We've got there only to the extent that we're allowed, okay? And that's the point. It's a very limited understanding of participation, because if we had got to participation, we would be changing the structures. We wouldn't be asking the question, in what, because we would have some kind of real power to change the institutions and structures and the processes, but we haven't. And so...
I meant it's a matter progress. Of law, yeah. It's a matter of language, yeah. Rather than a matter of actual
I have a problem constantly with this, the language of law, you set out what your four pillars are, and it is in Security Council resolutions, it is in the text, it is in the rhetoric, but how, do we see it materialise on the ground, in power, in real power to change? And I'm not sure that we, on one level we've progressed. On another level, I think they'd be a little bit disappointed with how little we've progressed, given, if you look at the, for example, one thing like technology, they would be, it would be mind-blowing for any of those women to be sitting here today, to be looking out, to see your laptops, the digital communications, and they'd be going, wow, what a different world. And yet, those relationships, the gendered relationships, it's same old, same old. We haven't really progressed, have we?
No, I agree with you completely. I think they'd be absolutely bloody furious. and I think one of the reasons for that is back to gender.
Yeah,
and you might want to pick up on that, because I think what you said yesterday in terms of unitary was really
well.
Helpful.
What we were talking about yesterday was essentially the binary of gender, and we were all saying we need to get away from the man-woman binary, and sort of look at much more fluid the notion that if gender is constructed, we can deconstruct it in a much more fluid way. But my concern is I don't think we even have a binary with gender. I think gender is taken over, and particularly, let's come back to the language of law, particularly in law, gender is understood as women. If you read the Women, Peace and Security resolutions, whenever they talk about gender perspective, gender sensitivity, what they mean is, just remember there are a couple of women around here and take them into account as well. But let's push that one stage further as well. You just talked about the language of law that I've picked up on, but the structures of law are also binary. Yeah. Not just the male, female, which law still firmly, with a few little exceptions coming in, but essentially still maintained, but, you know, intervention, non-intervention, war, peace, aggression, self-defense. Yeah, we just, all the way through, there is a right answer and a wrong answer in the legal constructions that are set up. And I think it is these binaries and the way law is categorized that comes right back to the structures that are needed to maintain, no, the underpinnings to the structures that are needed to maintain the power lines that you were talking about, and that which create the obstacles to being able to get to the root causes and move forward. Did that make sense? Or
it does totally completely.
She had to gather this. I was going to say, we have talked like this for what, two decades?
Yeah, 2 decades at least. So, I haven't cracked it yet. But I think that the cracking it is to come. Because I think going forward, there has been so much. I think the disruption of gender, because now we see very clearly that this binary is something that has been created artificially. I would say created artificially, because if you read the neuroscience and the evolutionary biologists, it is not innate. It is not. It is not. We are the same. It's just that social construct, which we all know is the defining element of gender, seems to have gone out the window while we see what happens to men, women, boys and girls, if we even do that. Mm-hmm. So if, and that means that we are pitted against men. Feminists are always against men, are we not? You know, and so men can't be in the same peace thing as we are, which of course is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense, because as I said before, we don't look at what men have been doing. We don't look at the conscientious objectors. We don't look at the men supporting the women. I was taken with Abigail Disney's film, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, and when we showed it at the Human Rights Council, the Swiss delegate said, I can't believe how proud I am at this moment to be a woman. And a guy from UNICEF said, and you have no idea how ashamed I am to be a man. And Abigail Disney was there, and she said, that's always the reaction first time you see it. Next time you see it, look and see what men are doing. And if you do look at it again, you see that you've got men who are carrying old women and sick people and helping. You've got men who are taxi drivers collecting money to save, to get the women to the peace talks. You've got a huge amount of network and support and protection, which you don't see, first of all, because all you see are the bad guys doing the terrible, horrible things. And then those people are the ones that are on the same side, but we don't get that narrative. We don't hear it, because it's not working for us if we are, not for us, but it doesn't work for the powers that be if we actually have that analysis. So I think what we've got to do is pay more attention to deconstructing toxic masculinity, as we were saying this morning. Well done, Gillette. And look at the reaction they had for that. You know, so, but, so those are the sorts of things we need to be doing to equalise it in a way which is good, not to do, let's have more women in the military, because that equalises it in a way which is bad. And as we said this morning, you know, how come, if we're going to change things away from the lean-in version of women's equality, do we really want to boast that we now have four of the biggest arms industries in the world headed up by women? And Cynthia Enloe's done a fantastic commentary on that. So if you're bought into the system, and all of these women were, who did extremely well in making sure weapons got to where they had to go to and all that sort of thing, then you're going to be rewarded by being the head of that organisation. Same with the women in the military. They climb their way up and they want to have equality in bearing arms. We are stuck with structures which actually coerce and co-opt. And you know, it's drifting away from my point a little in terms of the looking at gender from a different perspective and seeing it as a unitary concept based, which must reflect the idea of a fluidity between all of us, that we're not this, that, or the other. There is this constant movement. But how it manifests is a social construct. What we then do with that manifest is then structured. So allowing women to go through the so-called glass ceiling doesn't necessarily change it. I think that's the problem. Unless we went through en masse, and somebody said, never call it a glass ceiling, call it a membrane. Because the ceiling is broken. But a membrane, you go through it, seals behind you. And then the poor woman behind is going to come through the whole thing again. And I think that's a better analogy.
Do you want to come in again? Or shall we throw it open?
I think we should be throwing it open.
So off you go then.
I guess, you know, we were like talking about, well, you know, how do we want to end this conversation? And really the point of entry or ending is where we began. Are we asking the right questions? But what we want to do is to throw it open to you all and say, are we asking the right questions? Are we? What should we be asking? What must we ask?
And to whom?
That's true.
Yeah, who should we be asking these questions? Right, so instant responses. So I'll take 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Can you just say who you are? And you're probably going to have to speak up. And I've been told to repeat the questions so they get caught. Yeah.
Okay, I'm Grace. I'm in the Master's Women, Peace and Security program. So I had a question, since we're referring back to this image, and we talked about the suffragette movement. And as we know, it was rather exclusive of a certain type of woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, when we talk about that, how wealth and other peace-focused movements have reflected and revised their approach to be more inclusive, specifically of women of color.
Okay, we'll take 3 or 4 and then answer. So the question was essentially, how can wealth and other peace movements be inclusive, especially of women of color, but more broadly as well? Yeah.
Hi, Liat, also from the WPS Masters. So you were asking what has changed between the first war and today. Well, Professor Shenkina also mentioned the new wars concept, of course, that you and Professor Kaldor have been talking about. So is there a need to look at different types of conflicts? I mean, you're talking about the political, economic dimensions of war. So obviously they play a very strong part, and it's not just that wars are preventable, but also a lot of wars are not ending. In that sense, I'm Israeli, in case people do not know, and I'm looking to go, hopefully, my PhD to looking
Can
at
keep it fairly short.
Short
yeah.
At the also why militarization is so consistent in Israel, and when you're talking about political economy, you're talking a lot about the arms industry and about weapons, and obviously that's something that is very, very rooted in my country, but it's not the only one. So
what's the question?
How do you tackle the arms arms trade globally?
Right, how do you tackle the arms trade? Right. I shouldn't have pushed you to it, because it just becomes a rather big question.
Okay.
It's the right question.
Right.
It
okay.
is the right question.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go, there's
okay.
a right question.
There's a right question. I think it was here. Yeah?
So there's this documentary I watched on the YPG, the Kurdish female army, and it made me think about a lot of things. I couldn't have a stand on it because it's a female army following female military trainings, but then they are standing by other women in Syria, and they define themselves as feminists, and they want justice, liberty, and equality for everyone, not only for their community, but also they believe in the Kurdish nationalism, and they are fighting Erdogan. It's very, very
so again,
related.
The question?
The question is, in these cases where these women, if they don't fight, they're oppressed, should we ask them to stop fighting?
Yeah. It's a good question. Another very good question. And now there was something, it was you, was it? I'm sorry, yeah. And then I'll go
very short question, actually, very much related to what Samal was saying. So yesterday we had the privilege of assisting to Dr. Crimshaw, talking to us, and she was mentioning how sometimes we believe we're fighting the same fight, but we're not. The definitions of our terms are very, very different. So, you know, in terms of feminism, who are we talking? Are we talking as white feminists? Are we including black feminists? Are we including intersectionality as it really is? So I guess translating that to militarization and sort of relating to Sana'a, when we talk with feminists that call themselves feminists and are sort of launched in that struggle with us, but are very much pro NATO military structures and you know in the US all the military structures really, even at a local level and not just at an international level, how do we then define what our feminism is and how is the theirs?
How do we define feminisms
when
we have when we have so many different contexts and contexts that, in light of what we've been talking about, appear to be antithetical to what we're talking about? I'll take two more because I've seen two more hands that were quiet. Then we'll come back. Can you remember them?
I hope
there was one at the very back. Okay, so reclaiming the feminist agenda away, well, the WPS agenda in particular, out of the Security Council. We'll take one more at this round.
Thank you all very much. The name's Shimon Grant. I've worked with the successor agency to the KGB in Ukraine and alongside people who are in the Soviet era, GRU. So I've seen the legacy of fear and militarism. Ex-Soviet Union. My question is, I noticed that I don't think you've mentioned the experiences of the League in World War II. Is that because when you're dealing with people like Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin, there's not a lot of progress you can make? And I'm very interested in the point, the question, the remarks about Cameroon and the example. Do you have... does the League, in effect, have a sort of network of early warning, a network that can raise awareness quicker than it otherwise is done, because very often it's not done very well by mainstream political organisations? Thank you.
Thank you. So, essentially, the concept of early warning and how can that be made more effective?
And also, how do you deal with...
the psychopath, yeah. How do you deal with the
psychopath? Brexit again.
Okay, now, who would you have...
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Go for it.
Quick one, the one on Wilf. The question on how diverse are we?
Inclusivity.
I think we have done it to a certain extent. We've never done it enough, but we have expanded enormously. We were known as rather an older Western organisation, even though historically we'd had a lot of sections in India and branches in India and Pakistan and various other, but small, Nepal, not big enough. And Africa, very, very little indeed. But since 28, is it, the Congress before Costa Rica, we have started growing a movement which I think is much more global and much more diverse, to the extent that our biggest membership by far now is in Africa. And that has grown itself. You know, it wasn't us going and doing missionary work to save peace. No, they did it themselves, absolutely. And they came to Wilf and said, okay, you're a peace organization. We want to be part of this. And so now if you look at our board, our international board, you know, we have a woman from Nigeria. We have a president who is now from Nigeria. We have a deputy from Nigeria. We have a much more integrated, I think, much more representative organization than we've ever, ever had. And I'm really, really pleased with that. It's also a lot younger. And it's a lot more gender fluid, shall I say? So that's really good. And we're also getting men. You know, in Afghanistan, we've got a section which is more than 370 of them are men. Mm. So go figure. Because they want peace too. Yeah. So this amazing woman, she's just brought them all in. So, you know.
It's not a guilt.
So it's good, it's good. You know, so that, I think, is coming. It's not perfect. Of course, it's not perfect, and we need to be better. But there's, you know, so good, we're getting there, girls.
How do we tackle...
I was just going to say, can I come in on the Crenshaw thing? Because, you know, I mean, what's really interesting is the project that Christine and I'm working on. These were, in fact, this morning we were talking with Kana as well as Sherry, who are both also on this project. And there are a number of questions that are out there that we are trying to get our heads around. And this is one. And this is one that, you know, sort of that postmodern moment, you know, that sort of in this moment where we recognize difference. We also recognize kind of the history of where feminism has come, okay? And we're still back at, back at the question, and it's the who is we, okay? And most feminist scholars out there will say it's almost impossible to answer the who is we question. We are struggling with it, okay? But one way to, as a feminist, to tackle this is to say, well, as feminists, we understand that there is a plurality of we's, okay? So there isn't a single we, and in certain situations, for political purposes, I mean, for activism purposes, then we recognize that notwithstanding the diversity and the differences, it would be to our greater benefit to act as though we are a a singular we, whilst also never forgetting that we are not. But we actually also need to be attentive to those others who may not necessarily speak as loud as us. And we need to keep on making those spaces and keep on listening and allowing them to speak. I don't know.
No, I agree completely. And I can, just to say that peace is a process. It doesn't happen overnight. So when we look at what the Kurdish women are doing, it's not going to stop overnight. We're not going to say, oh, you must put down your guns because then it's going to get slaughtered. What we want to do is avoid a situation where women have to pick up guns in the first place, and that goes absolutely to the question about the Second World War and what do you do when you've got a psychopath in charge. You actually, that was the point, what Wilf was trying to do was use the League of Nations as a way of actually preventing that conflict before it became an inevitability. But it wasn't good enough because the structures were in place that actually led to it and facilitated it. Wilf was the organisation that actually was the only one said, Treaty of Versailles is wrong because this will lead to a rampant nationalism and a second conflict. And they were right. So that interwar period was to try to prevent that, and unsuccessfully, obviously. But that's the point. And I think also that would, in answer to your question, we have sections in more than 43 countries now. And one of the things that we are trying to, we do work with them very much to do, is to try and bring any information they've got, like from Zimbabwe, that saw that one coming, and from Cameroon and other places where conflict is uncertain, could happen, might happen, to get that information through the international system, whether it be using the treaty bodies, whether it be using the Universal Periodic Review, or whether it be by actually approaching states directly to say, look, this is burning, you're going to have to do something. We haven't got the system down perfectly yet, but we're a hell of a lot better than we used to be. So we have been able to do that. And one of the things we're talking about is to try and get preventative commissions of inquiry into countries to do that mediation work before it starts. Because once it starts, then it's very difficult to stop. And I think one of the things that I would like us all to understand, when I say peace is a process, it means that we are a long way from being able to understand and stop all the bad things happening. It's not like we're going to be able to wave the magic wand that overnight it all ends. We have to deal with neoliberalism. We have to deal with militarism. We have to make the UN effective again. There's a lot of work on that. We have to deal with how gender relations are formed and are put into effect. That's our structures. That's our understanding of who we are in a common humanity. All of those things take a long time, and it probably won't be done in my lifetime, but it might be done in yours. But we've got to understand that it will take this time, but we've got to not let any one of those little elements just slip past us, because if we pay it, as with 1325, you don't pay attention to the arms industry and militarism, then you let it sneak up behind you. You think you've done it, and no, you haven't, because that cancer is still there undermining everything else.
Missed opportunity.
Total missed opportunity.
So that's your answer to reclaiming WPS as well, then, I presume. And
yes,
so reclaiming
so.
It substantively,
and
or
can.
Pulling it out of the Security Council?
We are discussing. because of what ICANN did, we thought sneak a second attempt at trying to get the other states more engaged, because it has been made a security agenda and not a security agenda for women.
And not a human rights agenda.
Not
it's
human
lost
rights.
That
absolutely
human rights
so I think
framework.
Let's have another crack.
And peace.
And peace. That's how
peace.
It's a peace agenda rather than a security agenda.
One of our colleagues said, why is it called the Security Council, not the Peace Council? Why did it take till 1995 to create the Peace Commission?
Mm-hmm.
And why has almost nobody heard anything about the Peace Commission since it was created? It was 2005, wasn't it? It was the millennium. But it's more or less, so you can't even remember when it was created because it's more or less vanished.
Yeah.
So why is it always security, military, that is given the higher priority? We've probably got time for about two more questions or comments or joining into the discussion. Other questions? What else might we be asking? No? Yeah, go on. Do you want to come back in?
Was there a question over here?
Aiko.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
I'm not sure it's fully formulated as a question. That's why I was tentative. Hi, I'm Aiko. I'm a PhD student here. My question is to do with how do we, because Christine, you mentioned this, the series of binaries that structure thinking, and one of the massively problematic ones is peace and war.